Welcome to Aware. We are dedicated to communicating information that inspires your positive growth and change. Are you interested in a peaceful planet? Are you interested in optimal health? Are you living with purpose? Are you enjoying your life? We realize each person can make a difference, and our mission is to empower your awareness. The choices that you make in every moment shape your life, and we encourage you to realize that you have your own answers and to always listen to your own truth. We invite you to stay aware. Hello and welcome to the Aware Show. I am Lisa Garr, and it is such a true pleasure to be with you today. We have a lot of great information coming up for you today about the one thing that we all do and don't do. It's sleep. The one thing we all try to do. And I just want to mention really quickly, if you have the chance to go to my website, which is theawareshow.com, we have three or four other shows that we do per week. You can check them all out there, all fantastic, video, audio, whatever it is, but all information that is totally transformational. Now, my guest today, very smart guy, Dr. Michael Bruce. He has put together, his latest book is called The Power of When, and this is about chronotypes. And it's about it's about dogs. It's about raising dogs. About how to have what is the best time to eat lunch, to ask for a raise, to have sex, to write a novel, to do exercise, to take your meds, more. He talks all about sleep cycles and that we have different needs depending on our personality, body type, etc. And there's a formula that he has for this. He can determine your chronotype to discover if you're an early riser or a late riser, if you like staying up later, going to bed earlier. All these are considered chronotypes and what we struggle with and what we succeed at. So welcome, Dr. Bruce. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me. Sorry about the noise, my dog.
It's all good.
Amazon showed up, so you know how that goes.
Oh, no. I have so many dogs in my interviews that really want to say something. Whenever I start interviewing people, they want to speak. So I am used to it.
Gotcha.
Well, I'm glad you're
home. Thanks for having me back.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, all right, let's talk a little bit about what you do. You are a clinical psychologist, but you are also a diplomat of the American Board of Sleep Medicine. What is sleep medicine? It's a whole field, isn't it?
It is. So I'm actually bored. I took the medical boards without going to medical school and passed. And so I became a sleep specialist. And so that gives me the opportunity to work with medical doctors and help treat people for any kind of sleep disorder you might imagine. Believe it or not, there are 88 different sleep disorders out there. And when I learned that, I couldn't believe that there were 88 things that could go wrong in your sleep. But I think in my 17 years, I've probably seen almost all of them.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, and it's really amazing, you know, is because when they sleep, the sleep is really a window into their lives. And if you're not sleeping well, you know that there's something going on stressfully. You know that there could be something going on physically. You know that there could be something going on emotionally. So it really is a window into people's health on the emotional side, on the physical side, even on the spiritual side.
Have you been a part of the sleep clinics and the trials and so forth, monitoring people's sleep?
I have, and that was really where I did the majority of my clinical work for really the last 15 years. I worked in sleep laboratories, so you might come see me in my office, and I would say, sounds like you could have sleep apnea or narcolepsy or periodic limb movements, and so let's bring you down to the sleep laboratory, and then we have technologists that would stay up with them all night and monitor them, and we would attach, believe it or not, 27 electrodes to the body, and belts and video cameras and all these different things. And now you're probably thinking, my word, how could anybody actually sleep with all of that stuff on them? And usually the people are pretty tired to begin with, so it's usually not that big of a deal. But if you'll notice, I didn't say that we send people with insomnia down to the sleep laboratory, because if they don't sleep well to begin with, I can't imagine how bad they would sleep with 27 electrodes attached to their body.
They're not candidates.
So, yeah. And so we monitor their sleep all night long. And it produces a record that's about 500 or 600 pages.
Wow.
And then we have a computer analyze the record, and then a human being analyze it again, and then I get a summary report. And from that summary report, there are different things that I can learn, and then we diagnose them, and we treat them depending upon what's going on. And that's what it is to be a sleep doctor.
Wow, that is amazing. Is a process like this, is this covered under insurance?
It is. It is covered by almost, actually, I think it's covered by all insurers. And so that's not something that people have to worry about any longer. Way back
wow.
in the day, it was difficult to find an insurance company that would cover it, but now it's covered by everybody.
Fantastic, because they understand the health ramifications of not having sleep. So just run me through like a normal sleep cycle. If somebody goes into REM sleep, about how long after they fall asleep do they go into the REM cycle?
So it's interesting is what happens is you go from wake to stage one to stage two, then you go down into what's called deep sleep or stages 3 and 4, then back to stage two, and then on into REM sleep. And that's considered to be one sleep cycle. That sleep cycle takes on average about 90 to 100 minutes, and it takes you about 80 minutes to get to your very first part of REM sleep. But the thing to remember here is that not all sleep cycles are created equal. And so in the first third of the night, you have far more stage 3-4 sleep, which is the physically restorative sleep. In the latter third of the night, you have more REM sleep, which is more of the mentally restorative sleep. So it, depending upon when you wake a person up, they could be having different stages of sleep.
When do you dream?
So that's a great question. Dreaming, 80% of the time that you're in REM sleep, if we wake you up, you will be dreaming. But you can actually dream in any stage of sleep. I've woken people up in stage 2, stage 3, 4, and they certainly report dreaming during that time.
Wow, any stage. And have you ever looked into what you said the first third of the night is physical restoration and the later mentally restorative? What happens in the mentally restorative sleep cycle?
So during the mentally restorative sleep cycle, this is where we move information from our short-term memory to our long-term memory. We create an organizational substructure inside our brain to store information so that it's easy to retrieve, because you're going to need that information for things like how to drive a car or how to make a decision about, you know, your checkbook or which television show you might want to watch. So it has to be easy to retrieve, but it also we don't want that extra stuff that's just floating around. Stage 3 and 4 actually acts sort of like a filter, is what we've recently learned. And so the billboard that you drove by or the magazine article that really wasn't that important to commit to memory, those get filtered out during stage 3 and 4. And during REM, the really salient, important pieces of information then move into this organizational substructure, and you create association so it's easy to remember.
Interesting. So you're imprinting and so forth throughout the night.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
The brain is so fascinating. So it's taking these images that are important that maybe have more emotional charge, and it's making like a computer. It's just making files and storing.
Exactly.
Fascinating.
Exactly right.
And then can you, and I'm going to ask you some funky alternative questions here because this is my funky alternative world. Can
I love it.
You, God, you're the person that can answer them. Can you do this technique that I hear from many of the people I've interviewed? Ask yourself a question, and then your brain will figure it out at night. And you wake up in the morning with an answer.
So it's interesting. I would say kind of. So here's what we know is it's always better to sleep on it than it is to not. So you can ask yourself a question, and you may actually come up with some of those answers when you wake up. I know that whenever I've had big thought-provoking questions that I've tried to answer, that oftentimes I need to sleep on that because the information has to go in and kind of associate with other pieces of information for me to come to a conclusion. But I don't think if you go to bed and you say, hey, what's the lottery number going to be next week, you're going to wake up with the lottery number.
This is the title of your next book, Sleep on It. You could do a whole book on this. I mean, this is so interesting where you can – there's certain parts of the information and how it's processed that can actually get you to certain conclusions throughout the night, right?
Absolutely.
Think about that, though. Your brain can actually start to, in your unconscious state, I don't know how unconscious it is, but in that unconscious state, it could delete or segment out unnecessary information that in our conscious state we would think would be huge, but in our unconscious state it filters out the unnecessary information and then it chunks up the highly emotionally charged information. Wow, don't you wish we could do that during our day?
I know, right? Wouldn't that be fantastic if our brains could process that way? But unfortunately, there's just so much other stimuli that's wandering around that it's hard for our brains to really be able to,
like,
you know, center and focus.
Chocolate cake, chocolate cake, chocolate cake.
Exactly.
At night, that chocolate cake goes away and you actually get why you're eating the chocolate cake. It's great. Okay, let's talk about recording dreams. Is it possible to, we're doing some myth busting here, is it possible to write your dreams down first thing upon waking? Is that the best time to write a dream down?
It is if you really are trying to record the details of your dreams. But, you know, I always tell people to be cautious when they're doing that. And the reason is you may not want to remember all of your dreams. You know, once you kind of start a dream journal, if you will, where every morning you wake up and you write down what you dreamt about, if you're going through a rough time or you have nightmares or your dreams aren't particularly pleasant, I don't know how to turn that switch off once you do that. I don't know. I can tell you that if you write down your dreams every morning, you will absolutely begin to remember them. And it is the easiest way to remember your dreams. Now, I do know that there is a nightmare treatment by Dr. Barry Krakow out of the University of New Mexico, where what he has you do is he has you write down your nightmares in the most detail that you can and then read it right before you go to sleep, but change the ending so that you become the victorious person. So instead of being chased and killed, you chase somebody and kill somebody. Although I don't know if killing somebody is necessarily
does
the outcome
work,
that you want.
Does this work?
And it absolutely will change the content and the ending of the dream. And a lot of people have used this methodology, and it's been very effective.
Oh, that's great. That's especially great for children.
Yes.
And you change the outcome. All right. Well, the book is based on these chronotypes. The Power of When is the name of Dr. Bruce's book.
Yeah.
So chronotypes. What are chronotypes?
So chronotypes are genetically predetermined sleep schedules that all of our bodies have. This is all based on the PER3 gene, although there are other genes and genetic markers for morningness and eveningness. And this is what we know, is that historically we used to only think of chronotypes as early birds or night owls. And I use the word chronotypes because that really is the scientific term for it. But most people out there know somebody that's an early riser or somebody that's kind of a late night person. Well, probably within the last 15 years, we learned that there's actually people in the middle, and they would call them hummingbirds. And I always found this vernacular very strange. You know, I know I'm a mammal, not a bird. And so I really didn't want to be, you know, related to a bird. And then I also noticed that insomnia really wasn't playing prevalent into this categorization. And I thought to myself, you know, I've got patients who don't fall into any of these categories, and I don't know how they're being assessed. And so I said, well, first thing I need to do is change the names. So I changed the names, and so an early morning person is now called a lion. Middle of the day or middle person is called a bear. A night person is called a wolf. And an insomniac is called, or a problem sleeper is called, a dolphin. I actually chose creatures who actually keep these schedules. So lions are early morning. That's where their first kill is, at dawn. Bears get up with the sun and go to sleep with them when the moon comes up. Wolves are much more nocturnal creatures. They're up and about throughout most of the night. And dolphins actually sleep unihemispherically. So they only sleep with half of their brain at a time while the other half is awake and looking for predators. And I thought this made sense as a symbol, if you will, of some of my problem sleepers. So once I had the four categories, I had to figure out what each one was. Is that what you were about to ask?
So the early risers are the lions. You said that the bears are the ones that go to bed with the sun?
No, they go to bed with the rising of the moon.
They stay up late.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let me give you a description of all of the people. So my lions generally go to bed around 8:30, 9 o'clock, but wake up around 4:30, 5 o'clock. Mm-hmm. These are my super-duper early people. They have a tendency to be the COOs, the operators of a company. They're type A personalities, and they like to make a list, and they like to go from step one to step two to step three on their list. They're very regimented people. They like to kind of get things done. They make up about 10 to 15% of the population. My bears, which makes up about 50 to 55% of the population, are a little bit different. They're my solar sleepers. It's probably the best way to describe them. They go to bed around 10:30. They wake up around 7:30. In between there. And these are my extroverts. They have a tendency to be very much social creatures. These are the people who love getting work done. They have a good feel for work-life balance. But they also are pretty social. They're the people who are at the bar buying people a drink, or if you're having lunch with a bear, they're telling you a funny story or a funny joke, or they're up on current events, things like that. Okay. The wolves are, and I'm a wolf, by the way, are the night people. We don't like to go to bed but before midnight, and we certainly don't like mornings. We are much more on the introverted side, but we're also very much on the creative side. We might make a list at the beginning of the day, but we never follow it in order. We'll go from the first item to the sixth item to the 12th item to the second item and so forth. We're much more of a scatterbrained type of person, than the lions are. And my dolphins are actually kind of similar to my lions, but they fall a little bit into the neurotic category. They're type A personalities, highly intelligent. They like to get things done. But unfortunately, they seem to have a little bit of perfectionism in them to the point where they don't really like turning stuff in because it's not perfect. And so oftentimes that will get in the way of their levels of productivity, and oftentimes that leads them into my clinic. So those are the four different chronotypes as it stands right now.
I love how you broke all of this down, and this comes from your years of research around this. Speaking of your clinic, you have a clinic. Uh-huh. Is it local, or where is your clinic?
So I used to be associated with a clinic when I was living in Arizona. I've recently moved to Los Angeles, and so now I actually am doing more lecturing and less clinic work. I still read sleep studies for a group that I worked with in the past, and occasionally I take on an occasional client. But now more than ever, it's really I've been doing a lot of lecturing, talking with the book, and then working with big companies and corporations about how to incorporate sleep either as an HR program or just for their corporate executives.
That's fascinating. Also, you've been a big Dr. Oz is a big fan of yours, and you've been on his show 30-something times, right?
Yeah, I've been very, very fortunate that the Dr. Oz show has placed a high value on sleep and what sleep is and how sleep works. Mm-hmm. And that's been great for me. I actually had my 38th appearance on the show.
Fantastic. Well, that really means you're getting the word out there about sleep, which is important.
Okay. I'm trying. With the help of somebody like Dr. Oz, he's definitely made it easier.
That's fantastic. So, all right. So you've broken these categories down into lions, bears, wolves, and dolphins. Now, you mention in the book again, this is about when is the best time for you to do specific things. So if you take an early riser and you try to have a conversation with that person at night, it's not going to work. And it takes kind of the blame out of it. My husband's the early riser. He is the lion. I am the wolf.
Got it.
I do late night radio. He does early morning phone calls. So, yeah, we are ships in the night, which is amazing. What do you suggest for, when you're in a relationship with people like that, that are opposites?
It's tough, and that's part of what we talk about in the book. And so in the book, I talk about when's the best time to have sex, when's the best time to talk about, your feelings, when's the best time to talk to your children. I mean, chronotypes are interesting because when you wake up, that's kind of when your hormones start to kick into gear and different things happen. So as an example, when you wake up, your cortisol levels are high, your adrenaline is high, your melatonin is low. And so there are certain activities that would be better to be performed then than later in the day when, let's say, your cortisol levels are low or your, let's say, your adrenaline is high. So what I did was I actually looked at these natural occurring waveforms or hormone flow. And so it's all predicated on the wake-up time. And so if you wake up at a certain time, that's when kind of the race starts for your hormones. And then they go through a very particular up and down flow, if you will. And so what I did was I looked at different activities during the day, and I said, what hormones do you need for this activity? Okay, when is that hormone naturally at its highest point? And that's the perfect time of day to do it.
Okay. So when someone who sleeps, goes to bed very late and stays up all night, when is our cortisol the highest?
So it turns out that your cortisol is actually delayed pretty significantly, too. Mm. So as an example, let's say you're a night owl like me, and you don't go to bed until, let's say, 1 o'clock in the morning. Your cortisol levels are probably not going to be on the rise until probably 8:30. Whereas if you were a lion and an early night person, you went to bed at 8:30, 9 o'clock, waking up at 5:30, your cortisol levels will be at their peak at around 5:30, 6 o'clock. So there's a huge disparity between when these hormones will be at their peak, depending upon your chronotype.
Now, what about senior citizens? Is it true when you get older you need less sleep?
It's interesting. So with my senior citizens, what ends up happening is they end up turning into lions or into dolphins. Hmm. There's a natural circadian shift that occurs later in life where people have a tendency to go to bed earlier and wake up earlier. Or there's a tendency for them to get poor quality sleep. And that poor quality sleep oftentimes is simply because of medical situations that might be going on in their lives or medications that they might be taking. So it's, you know, you can see differences in sleep depending upon what's happening for them. But generally speaking, most senior citizens need roughly the same amount of sleep. They just might need it at a different time than they normally did. Also, because many of them don't work or have a real regimented schedule, they can take naps during the day, which oftentimes will offset their sleep needs at night.
Okay, so that does tend to change a little bit. Now,
it does.
You gave the dolphins the unihemispheric. Can you explain to us a little bit about a little animal education here?
Uh-huh.
How does a dolphin's brain work?
So it's interesting. So literally half of their brain is asleep while the other half is awake and looking for predators. And then it will switch after a certain period of time. They're the only mammal out there that does something like this. So it's rather unique. It's kind of a fun trivia fact. You know, if you're ever playing Trivial Pursuit and animals come up, you'll certainly know one of the most unique facts about an animal, especially an animal's sleep, than anything else.
Hmm. Interesting. I mean, if you really think about it, horses, the same thing. They really can't, they don't lay down. They sleep standing up. I'd love to.
Yep. They do. The reason they sleep standing up apparently is because they're able to lock out their elbow and knee joints, and it's almost like a post. The reason that cows sleep on the ground is because they don't have that capability, and so you'll see cows lie down, but you'll see horses standing while they're sleeping, and so that all has to do with physiology.
Oh my goodness! You know a lot about animals and their sleep patterns.
It's funny how many times I get asked questions about it, so I had to look it up.
Look it up. Okay, let's talk about travel. So you're on an airplane and you're in different time zones. How do you work with that in terms of sleep cycles?
So it's tough. You know, first of all, the human body will adapt to a time zone. One day for every hour time zone crossed. So the big thing that people have to remember is if you're going on a fairly short trip, a 3-day trip, it's probably not worth it to try to change, you know, your time zones, because by the time you start to really acclimate, you're going to turn around and come right back. So oftentimes I'm telling people to adjust prior to their travel. You can start going to bed earlier if you're traveling east, or you can start going to bed later if you're traveling west. It turns out that the direction of travel has a pretty significant effect. So the way I remember it is east is least and west is best. And what I mean by that is that if you travel towards the east, basically we're asking you to go to bed earlier. So if I ask you to go to bed at 6:30 tonight, while you might be able to lie down and be a little bit on the tired side, you certainly wouldn't be able to get a full night's rest. However, if I asked you, hey, can you stay up until 1 o'clock in the morning, you could do that pretty easily. So Western travel is basically staying up later. Eastern travel is going to bed earlier. And that's where the problems can come in. So if you go to your destination and it's 12-hour difference, let's say you go to Europe or to London or someplace like that, one of the things that I'm often recommending for people to do is if they can, take the overnight flight. Hopefully you've been able to get into business class so that you can lie your seat flat and sleep. And then arrive in the morning and then go on a walking tour. The reason I say go on a walking tour is because you want to get bright sunlight. It turns out that sunlight is the thing that turns on and off the melatonin faucet in your head. And so the best thing that you can do is to get sunlight right when you arrive at your destination. It's almost like getting a cup of coffee. And by the way, caffeine is not a bad idea either, because that can actually be quite helpful in maintaining your wakefulness. Then about an hour and a half or so before you want to go to bed, that's when you would take a supplemental melatonin. For those folks out there who need to remember, melatonin is kind of that key that starts the engine for sleep. It's really something that's essential for people to have, and it really is the thing that teaches your brain what time to go to bed. So by using light, caffeine, and melatonin, and a little bit of strategic napping, most people can reduce their jet lag pretty dramatically.
Interesting. So there's hacks, there's workarounds with these types of things, which is great.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Does it mean anything significantly if somebody cannot get out of bed early? Is there any health issues to do with stuff like that when, you know, I mean, even though I might be a wolf, or if people stay up late at night, what about on a normal 8-hour night? Is there any significant problem with someone who can't get up in the morning?
Well, if somebody can't get up in the morning, then my concern, first of all, is could they be on the wrong chrono schedule, right? Mm. So could, in fact, they say to me, hey, I'm trying to get up at a time when my body doesn't want to get up? Or could it be a quality issue, right? So maybe they're in bed for 8 hours, but what if they're getting really crappy sleep? If they're not doing, you know, if they're not getting really good sleep, then one of the things that I would be concerned about is could they have something like sleep apnea or narcolepsy, depression, a sleep disorder or an emotional disorder that could make them not want to get up and out of bed. Because most people, after they've been in bed for, you know, somewhere between 6.5 and 7.5 hours, they're really ready usually to get out of bed.
Huh. So this could be an indication that someone is not sleeping as well at night and may not even know it, though, right?
Absolutely. And I would tell you that actually in most cases, people don't realize that they're not that they're not sleeping well in most cases.
In most cases. So the best indication is if you're tired all day or if you go to a sleep clinic. Are there other ways to find out?
Well, to be honest with you, the best thing to do is to talk with a sleep specialist. Mm-hmm. Because you really want to – the big concern, of course, is driving a vehicle. You really want to be careful. Because if you're sleepy and driving a vehicle, it can be incredibly dangerous, not just for you, but also for the other people on the road.
Right, exactly. So now what about things like best ways to wake up? Is it individualized or is water good? Your dog is chiming in again.
Yeah. Oh, is that my dog? Might be, sorry. So here's what I would tell you is my kind of how to become a morning person routine. So step number one is most people don't realize it, but in your breath, in the humidity of your breath, you actually breathe out almost a full liter of water each night.
Cool.
And so, yeah, I know, it's amazing, right? And so the very first thing you should do is not drink a cup of coffee. The very first thing you should do is drink, you know, 12 to 16 ounces of water. That's going to be super duper critical to allow you to rehydrate. Step number two is to get some direct sunlight. So walk over to the window and be able to get some of that direct sunlight into your eyeballs, because that's going to help wake you up as well. Next, you want to do something that can help with your breathing, whether that's 10 or 15 push-ups, sit-ups, squat bends, whatever it is that you want to do just to kind of get your heart pumping. Then go ahead and go into the bathroom, and you want to hop into the shower, and you want to take a cool, not cold, but cool shower. The cool water shunts blood to your torso, and that actually can help wake you up as well. And I recommend bringing music into the shower. You know, if I walk into the shower, my son, in his bathroom, he is usually got some kind of crazy music going, and he's bopping around, and it really definitely helps wake him up. And at age 15, there's not a whole lot that's easy about waking up a 15-year-old. So
yes.
I would say that's certainly something to do. Hold off on your cup of coffee. Now, this is going to seem counterintuitive, but because your body has used cortisol and adrenaline to help lift you out of a state of unconsciousness, adding caffeine to them isn't going to do you a whole lot of good. However, if you wait for your body's cortisol rhythm to naturally move down, then drink your caffeine, you'll have a lot more power to the punch. So it only takes about 90 minutes. So if you wake up at 6:30, if you can hold off on having your coffee till about 8 o'clock, you'll be pleasantly surprised to find out how much more oomph you kind of get from that. And then, of course, having a high-protein, high-good-fat breakfast is going to be essential to give your brain the fuel and the energy it needs.
Mm. So that, now, what about if you add alcohol in the night before? These are important questions.
Absolutely. So there's some data that would now show that one or two drinks is not going to be particularly harmful to your sleep, assuming that you give yourself enough time to metabolize it out. It takes the human body approximately 1 hour per alcoholic beverage. So getting that out of your system, so if you stop drinking at 8 and go to bed at 10, you should be fine. The problem is when you go over two drinks. There's a lot of data to show that there's a very big difference between going to sleep and passing out. The passing out is not so good for sleep. In fact, half of the reason why you have a hangover is from lack of deep, physically restorative sleep. The other half is due to dehydration.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay. Well, these are just, helpful tips.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So in terms of when you're looking at the chronotypes, is this a well-studied field? Is this something that you have that you've really researched a lot and moved into? How long has this existed?
So chronotypes have been around since the mid-70s was when they were first discovered. And probably for the last 15 to 20 years, the research has really started to crank out.
Mm.
In my book, I've cited over 300 studies are cited in the book. And I don't do this kind of research. What I did was I started to investigate it, and I realized that nobody had kind of put it together in a way that people could utilize it and, make their lives better. And so my goal here was really to get people to understand the idea behind chronotypes and then just try one or two things, whether it's having sex at a different time, having your coffee at a different time, or talking to your children at a different time. All of those can have really positive effects on your overall life.
Okay. So talking to children, let's just start there.
Mm-hmm.
You would have a different time to talk to a child, and then I would have a better time to talk to a child? Or we're both wolves?
Here's the thing, is what you want to think about is the child and their chronotypes, right?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So when you think about their chronotype and what time are they willing to listen, that's where it kind of gets, a little bit more interesting. So as an example, thinking about grade schoolers, right? Or actually, let's talk about infants. So we know infants are, the majority are, they can be sleepy during the day and active at night, or so some of them have a tendency to wake up really early. Toddlers and kindergartners, those are lions, right? They wake up before dawn and they fall asleep early, and they usually benefit a lot from afternoon naps, allowing their bodies to recharge, whereas grade schoolers, the majority of them are bears, right? They're kind of solar sleepers, while teenagers are ultimately wolves, right? They are zombies in the morning with their energy kind of surging at night. And so when you start to think about these different times and understanding what's kind of going on with them, there are a couple things to kind of think through. So as an example, if you've got a child between the ages of 1 and 6, you really want to initiate important conversations sort of immediately after lunch or dinner. The little lions will experience a drop in blood sugar, and for about 30 minutes they actually slow down enough to listen to what you have to say. Because between ages 1 and 6, they're just go, 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 move, move, move. Looking at ages 7 to 12, initiating talks after school, somewhere between 3 and 5 o'clock in the afternoon, actually is really quite good. I've actually often advised parents to talk to kids while they're in the car and driving them to, either extracurricular classes or sporting events, because not having that face-to-face dynamic can actually be very helpful. They're usually snacking on something in the back of your car, and a lot of times you can kind of get through to them. When you hit the 13-year-olds, that's where stuff gets kind of weird. If I pick my daughter up from the bus stop, she's 13. If I pick her up from the bus stop, I get one-word answers to all of my questions. But if I walk into her room at 10:30 at night, she is a chatty Cathy and will talk to me about just about anything. So looking for these kind of time zones can actually be incredibly helpful for getting your point across.
Oh, my goodness. That's my daughter hates that when I capture her in the car. And she
How
can't
old is
get
she?
Out. No, she's 14. No, she's...
Right. So she doesn't... Right, because she wants to talk to you at 10 o'clock at night. When,
oh, yes.
When actually you would be fine.
I mean, sometimes. I'm usually... That's my... The reason I like that time is because it's my quiet hour and I can get a lot of stuff done. But she wants to talk about the day. But it's all good. Let's talk about teenagers for a second in school. So... I loosely heard on the news one day that there was a movement to have teens start school later. Have you heard anything
Correct.
About that?
Yeah, yeah. So there's a lot of data out of the University of Minnesota where they've looked at changing school start times. And what they've discovered is by moving school start times a little bit later, in children's first period class, oftentimes they're doing significantly better by being able to sleep in. It's more on the teenager side than on the toddler and middle schooler side.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a lot of data to look at changing school start times, and it can be very effective.
I wonder how long that will take. But keep coming out with your research.
Well, you know, the problem there is that the school buses run at a particular time, and parents have to get to work at a particular time.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's actually a real problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny, in my children's school, there's one student who's trying to get this movement going of starting school later, and the wall that she keeps coming up against is the sports teams have practices at a certain time, and then they have a game, and then they have to get on a bus, and the parents don't want to, you know, miss work, and so it's actually quite complicated.
It is. Interesting. What about naps for adults? Do you suggest them? How long? What do they do?
So I like napping in general, but I don't like napping if, in fact, you are an insomnia person. If you do not sleep well, napping is about the worst thing that you can do because it decreases your overall sleep drive, and it also changes your circadian rhythm a little bit. And so my dolphins are never allowed to nap. My lions, oftentimes, because they get up at 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning, sometimes they will take a nap in the early afternoon, and that can be actually quite helpful for them. I don't have a problem with naps in general, but you got to be careful. You don't want to nap too long. I don't know about you, but I've taken a nap before where I woke up and I feel worse than when I started, right? And that is because I slept too long and got into a deeper stage of sleep. And when you get into a deeper stage of sleep, what you will discover is it's very difficult to wake up. So keeping your naps to 25 minutes or less oftentimes is really kind of your best bet.
I have, though, is there any science to the fact that the brain can actually do a slight bit of self-organizing in about 20 minutes? Can that happen?
It can, depending upon the timing of your nap. There's different data out there. There's one study that showed that a 7-minute nap was actually helpful for some people. So I think it depends a little bit upon yourself and what time you nap. We know that memory improvements can occur for napping in the morning along with some creativity, whereas more logistical information seems to be a little bit easier to retrieve if you're napping in the afternoons.
What do you mean napping in the morning? You mean like 11 o'clock?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, think about it like this. If you got up at 4:30, you know, taking a 10:30 nap 6 hours later, you know, it's not that crazy of an idea.
You're right. Absolutely. I'm just, I have spoken with some people saying that the brain actually can self-regulate itself when you go through certain nap patterns. Is that a possibility? It was more of a neurofeedback conversation that I think I remember.
I don't know the answer to that question.
Yeah.
I'm not super familiar with neurofeedback. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, it's, I was just wondering about that concept, is that if the brain can actually regulate itself through sleep. But that essentially is what you're saying when you...
I think it does in evening sleep. I'm just not convinced it does in napping or daytime sleep.
Got it. Okay. So what is the best time? Let's talk about sex. What is the best time to have sex for, you know, if you have an opposite that you're sleeping with or the same?
Well, so generally speaking, it's much better to have sex in the morning than it is in the evening. About 72% of sexual activity occurs between 10:30 and 11:30 at night. And that's really about convenience more so than it is about anything else. The truth of the matter is that the hormones that you need to have sex, which are estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, adrenaline, and cortisol, are all lower in the evening, and melatonin is high. Well, that's the opposite profile of what you really want to have when you're having sex. You want your melatonin to be low, and you want all those other hormones to be high. Well, when is the time that they're most elevated? The morning times. And this shouldn't be a big shock to anybody. I mean, if anybody out there has slept or sleeps next to a male, then they'll notice that they have an erection in the morning. If that's not a sign from Mother Nature that that's what you're supposed to be doing in the morning, quite honestly, I don't know what is.
Okay. Well, so that's just basically when the hormones are in the right place.
Exactly. Huh. Exactly. Now, if you're a wolf like you and I are, you might not be aroused that early in the morning, especially if you're married to a lion. So in the book, I actually created a matrix where people can actually figure out, based on each one of their chronotypes, the timing for sexual activity.
Wow, that is so helpful. Absolutely very, very helpful.
I'm here to help. I'm here to help.
You're doing a great job of it. Okay, so are there tips that you have for how to go to sleep? Tips for going to sleep?
Sure. So first of all, it's hard to go to sleep when you're not kind of on your chronorhythm. So for me, as an example, I don't go to bed before midnight because, generally speaking, I'm not tired before midnight. And getting in bed when I'm not tired is really just an effort and frustration. So figuring out what your chronorhythm is certainly going to be helpful, number one. Number two is, sleep is not an on-off switch. It's more like slowly pulling your foot off the gas and slowly putting your foot on the brake. There's a process that has to occur. And so in order for that to occur, you have to give yourself the opportunity. So I use something that I call the power down hour. So let's take me, for example, going to bed at midnight. Right around 11 o'clock, here's what I do, is I break up that last hour into three distinct 20-minute categories. One is just things that have to get done around the house before the next day. So in our case, I'm helping getting my kids' lunches together or packing their backpacks or something like that. Maybe even answering a last-minute email, although that's not what I like to do. 20 minutes for hygiene, brush your teeth, wash your face, maybe take a hot bath or a hot shower, because there's data to show that that can help with sleep. And then 20 minutes for some form of relaxation. It could be meditative. It could be watching television. It could be reading a book. It's just something to allow your brain to relax, because that's really what's necessary in order to get to sleep. But if you follow this rule, the power down hour, you'll be surprised at how effective it is.
What about this whole blue light thing with cell phones? I noticed that my phone actually has this new update. It has a turn off your blue light function on it now.
Exactly. So it turns out that light in the light spectrum, at about 460 to 480 nanometers, is right where we see blue light. And this wavelength of light, if it hits these certain cells in your eye called melanopsin cells, they send a signal to your brain to turn off the melatonin faucet. So blue light turns melatonin off, which is, generally speaking, not a good idea, especially if you're trying to sleep. So what we try to do is we try to avoid blue light, either with devices on our computer. There's a free software program called Flux that people can use, devices on our phone. I wear blue blocking glasses at night. While they might look
glasses.
A little goofy.
What are those?
Yeah. They're special non-prescription lenses that you can put on that will actually block out the blue light. They reduce eye strain, and they really help your brain get into that sleep mode. They're actually very effective. Also, there are specialized light bulbs that you can buy. I have light bulbs in my bedside table lamp that block out the blue light. They're made by a company called Lighting Science Group. So if people are out there looking for them, and they're actually fairly inexpensive, they're $24. And I have one in each one of my bedside table lamps, and it works quite well.
What does the blue light do? And then we could talk about light, you know, like through windows.
Mm-hmm. So blue light, it has this effect on these melanopsin cells, and then what it does is it stimulates them, and then when they become stimulated, they send this signal that basically says, hey, brain, it's morning. You shouldn't be trying to fall asleep, and it turns off the melatonin faucet in the brain.
Mm-hmm. Does regular sunlight do the same thing?
It does.
If you want to sleep in?
And so that's why every morning when you wake up and you get regular sunlight, it helps reset your clock. And so that's what you're trying to avoid doing at night.
But if you want to sleep in, close the shades.
Exactly.
Hmm. Interesting. So it's really hard, no matter what, you're going to wake up if sun comes through to your eyelids during the morning.
Absolutely. That is a fact. We see that happen all the time.
What about night workers that try to sleep during the day? They just have to black out their environments.
Shift work is extremely difficult. You know, the human body was really not meant to work the night shift. And so it definitely becomes quite problematic for a lot of shift workers. We know that people who are shift workers, they have lower immune function. They have higher rates of cancer. It's a big issue a lot of the time. And so most of the time, there are specialized programs that can be developed specifically for people with shift work, like wearing these blue blocking glasses, reducing their exposure to light, things of that nature.
Is there a relationship between weight gain and night shift work?
With night shift work, yeah, there is. But there's also a relationship between weight gain and
lack of sleep.
Lack of sleep, mm-hmm. sleep deprivation, mm-hmm. exactly. So, yeah, it's definitely, there's definitely relationships there. And we know that a lot of shift workers, without even meaning to, can put on the pounds.
Is it because the metabolism cannot reset? Or explain that. Why?
So when a person's body becomes sleep deprived, several things happen on a hormonal level. Number one, your cortisol level goes up because your brain doesn't know why you're awake. And like I said before, it's very hard to go to sleep when you have high levels of cortisol. Number two, your metabolism slows down because it's trying to conserve resources in your body. Your body is trying to hold on to the fat, as it were, because it doesn't know what's happening. Number three is certain hormones go a little haywire. One is the hormone called leptin, and this is the hormone that tells you to stop eating if you have a lowered amount of leptin. And then the other hormone is called ghrelin. And ghrelin is the hormone that makes you want to go and eat. And so there's more ghrelin and less leptin. And so you can see, I'm not painting a very pretty picture here. You've got high cortisol, which leads to high appetite. You've got low metabolism. You've got high ghrelin, and you've got low leptin. And so all of these things lead to people gaining significant amount of weight.
Wow. So, there's not a lot of things that you can really do to combat that, can you? Unless
well,
you sleep.
One of the things I talk to people about all the time is, you know, that it's really important to get your rest. And if you're on a diet, it's even more important. Sleeping six hours a night while you're dieting is not going to work your diet very well. You know, getting that 6.5, 7.5, even 8 hours of sleep, again, depending upon what your sleep need is, and everybody has a different sleep need, is going to be very, very important.
Yeah. I mean, it all boils down to finding ways to be able to have your best night's sleep. Now, what about, there's a lot of different devices out there. Do you know anything about the best one that helps you sleep? There's LED devices. There's these eye masks. Any ones that you recommend?
Well, it really depends upon what's going on with you. Like if you're looking for really good eye shades, there's a company called Dream Essentials that makes, I think, some of the best eye shades in the market. If you're looking for earplugs, I like there's a company called Earplanes, like airplane, but earplane. They do a really good job because it helps drown out all kinds of noise. Mattresses, we could talk for hours and hours about different mattresses because there's so many of them out there that are actually very good. It's difficult. Unfortunately, with marketing the way it is, it's difficult to get any real good information about exactly what you're looking for in order to find, you know, that right solution. But don't be discouraged. It's certainly not impossible. You just have to kind of sit down and really think through these ideas.
What does the eye mask do, the Dream Essentials?
So the eye mask is basically used to block out light. And the reason that I like the one from Dream Essentials is because it's got specialized eye cavities inside of it. So that way your eyelashes don't rub up against the inside of the mask, number one. And number two, it has these special nose pads so that light can't sneak in underneath the eye mask right where your nose meets the front of your face.
Oh, okay. So it's a really good – oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
That's really nice. And then for people who snore – all right, let's talk about – that's a big deal. When you have someone who snores or
deal.
You are a snorer, How much does that keep you up?
Well, there's data that now suggests that if you sleep next to a snoring bed partner, you will lose approximately 1 hour of sleep a night.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. And not the snorer, but you. So snoring's a big deal, and I talk with people about it all the time. My favorite new discovery is something that you can actually get at Walgreens. It's called a Mute, M-U-T-E, and it's what's called an internal nasal dilator. So what's cool about Mute is you can actually put it up inside somebody's nose, and it will open up the nasal cavity, and you can feel it for about 30 seconds, and then it goes, you don't feel it anymore, and it really helps with snoring significantly.
Wow. And you can't really feel it that much. That's so interesting.
Nope, you can't. It's amazing.
For the person that is snoring, are they awake most of the night?
No, not unless they have apnea. But generally speaking, no.
Wow, that is amazing that the person who's in the room is awakened more than they are, even though they can't breathe.
That's correct. And so we do know that in some cases, depending upon how bad the snoring is, it can have an effect on the quality of the person's sleep. That is true.
That is interesting. What about these NyQuil and so forth? My husband had allergies, and he was up all night coughing, and so was I. So he finally took NyQuil to knock him out. It's, you know, an over-the-counter thing, but do you recommend it or no?
Do I recommend NyQuil or over-the-counter sleep aids?
Yeah.
Well, here's the thing is most of the PMs that are out there, they're just Benadryl, right? They're just diphenhydramine.
Okay. So
I'm not a huge fan of over-the-counter medications for a couple of reasons because they're all use Benadryl. And Benadryl is really not a compound that was built to last only 6, 7, or 8 hours. It's a compound that was built to last for 10 or 12 hours. And so that becomes problematic because people oftentimes get a hangover from these PM medications. So that part is not so great. And the truth of the matter is they're fine to use every once in a while. But if you find yourself using them on a very regular basis, like more than once a week or twice a week, then you probably need to talk with a sleep specialist to figure out what's really going on because that could be, a sign or a symptom of a sleep disorder.
Interesting. So, yeah, I mean, in my husband's case, when he had that those allergies, he was waking up in the middle of the night coughing. So taking the NyQuil in the middle of the night, couldn't get out of bed in the morning. So that's very common. So they're meant to last 10 hours. Okay, good to know. And then what about the, let's talk about food if we can. Have you ever heard of people that are hungry in the middle of the night or want to eat in the middle of the night? Have you ever heard of that? Or does our hunger actually subside in the middle of the night?
So, you know, it depends. If you do find yourself getting hungry in the middle of the night, oftentimes that could be a blood sugar issue. Where you're having a big spike, you know, if you're eating really late, you have a big spike in blood sugar, and then your body kind of dips down and kind of goes through a crash, and it's used to, you know, high amounts of blood sugar. So sometimes that can happen to people. Generally speaking, your body should go into sort of a fasting mode. You're not requiring as much fuel, as it were, and so the good news is you shouldn't require as much energy. But if you do wake up in the middle of the night and find yourself being hungry, in some cases that can be an early sign of diabetes. And so that's something that you're going to want to check with your physician about. Or it could be that your eating schedule is off. And so that's another thing you might want to look at.
I'm fascinated by the sleep cycle of how we just go comatose and then throughout the 60s. I mean, you think about how much you get done in 8 hours of a day. And then you think about the fact that your body lays there for 8 hours, ideally. What happens? Is there a certain hormone or something that happens in the brain that doesn't enable the body to move?
There is. So there's a paralysis that occurs specifically during REM sleep so that you don't act out your dreams, number one. But also we know that, all creatures with a spinal column and a nervous system have a time of rest. And it really, you know, you should think about it like recharging the batteries. I mean, that really is the time when it makes a lot of sense to kind of get that energy stores back, to kind of hit the reset button, if you will. And so other systems have to shut down in order to do that, and that's why we are unconscious. But the truth of the matter is nobody really knows why we sleep.
I ask that about my cats all the time, why they sleep 20 hours a day. They don't grow, but they...
they do like their sleep.
They do love their sleep. I've always wanted to come back in my next life as my house cat. So that would be impossible. But so the idea of the body goes into, is it a chemical or a hormone that allows that sleep paralysis to happen? What is it?
So it's both. It's a neurochemical and a hormone. It's actually kind of complicated. There's a couple of different things that go on, but it hits the movement center in the pons, and it basically paralyzes you so that you can't act out your dreams.
Huh. That's amazing. It really is such a complex system, sleep is. It's quite miraculous that all of this happens and we're completely unaware of it. Have you ever looked into hypnosis or wondered why or how that works?
So in graduate school, I took one course where we had one section on hypnosis where I was able to learn a little bit more about it. And my understanding is that you need to be hypnotizable in order to be hypnotized. And there are some people that are more believers than others. And I think if you believe in it, you have a far greater likelihood of it being effective and working for you.
So, yes. So you have to be suggestible and hypnotizable. I wonder if there's
right.
certain people that are predisposed to that. But that's interesting.
But I would bet that there are.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a certain profile. People in Vegas probably know a lot about that. okay, well, that is fascinating that there is truly in an endless amount of study that you can do on something like this and lots of questions. So if people want to get the book, which is great, you can go to Amazon and get the book or you can wherever books are sold. It's called The Power of When. Meaning discovering your chronotype. Michael Bruce is my guest, and it's Bruce is my guest. Mm-hmm. And it's great for you to get to a gift for your partner, maybe, that has a totally different sleep cycle. They can understand each other. There's these great clocks in the book that have your master clock, like the dolphin master clock and the lion master clock. And there's different ways where you can really find the best times to the best and the worst times to negotiate, to get rich, to sell,
exactly.
to tell a joke. You've really done a great job with this. Thank you so much. This is a great amount of research.
Well, thank you. It's been fun. And if people want to just learn their chronotype, they can come to my website, which is www.thepowerofwhenquiz.com and take the quiz. It takes 2 minutes and you'll learn your chronotype right there on the spot.
Beautiful. Thank you very much. All right. Thanks, Michael. Take great care, okay?
Thank you.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. So that is a great – he's such a great guy too, terrific guy. All right. Well, in the meantime, you can go to my website to listen to this show again at theawareshow.com. It's theawareshow.com. You can hear a replay of the show, plus hear all of the other shows that we broadcast every single week. And thank you so much to Gina Salvati, executive producer of the show, and Joyce Walker, producer of the show. And to all of you listening, it's your energy that makes these shows happen. So thank you so much. And until next time, this is Lisa Garr, and I invite you to stay aware.